Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Just hours after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, President Biden implored Americans to elect more Democrats in the midterm elections.
This fall, we must elect more senators and representatives who will codify women's right to choose into federal law once again. Elect more state leaders to protect this right at the local level. We need to restore the protections of Roe as law of the land. We need to elect officials who will do that. This fall, Roe is on the ballot.
If that sounds a little familiar, here is then-Senator Barack Obama during his first presidential campaign back in 2007, speaking at a Planned Parenthood event.
Well, the first thing I do as president is sign the Freedom of Choice Act.
But by the 100th day of his presidency in 2009?
The Freedom of Choice Act is not my highest legislative priority.
And now that's despite a 2008 election sweep that gave Democrats firm control of both Congress and the White House. Yet the Freedom of Choice Act was never sent to the president's desk in either term of the Obama administration. Friday's Supreme Court opinion in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health reversed Roe v. Wade and explicitly turned over abortion policy to, quote, the people and their elected representatives, leading many to ask what elected Democrats are prepared to do to ensure safe, legal access to abortion. I'm joined now by Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine, and the author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca, welcome back to The Takeaway.
I am very happy to be here, though wish it were under other circumstances.
Absolutely. Look, one of the first conversations I had following the decision was with my mother, who was an adult person before Roe v. Wade. And I was so surprised that among the first things where she was expressing anger was she was expressing anger about President Biden, about President Obama, about Democrats. And I was like, oh, whoa. You know, she is like, she's a white woman chronic voter, right? Like she is the demo, and she was mad, not so much with the court. I mean, certainly there, but with Democrats.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the case for me, too. It's certainly the Democrats have been the subject of a lot of my writing on this in the past couple of years, but also going back to the early part of my career where I was just like a little rudimentary baby feminist. and I wasn't very good at this kind of thing, but was beginning to think about these things in more complex ways. And if I go back and look at what I was writing in 2006, 2007, 2008, coming after 2004, I have a story for you about Democrats coming out of the 2004 presidential loss of John Kerry. You know, the issue they all went running from was abortion. Right? Like that was why Democrats, that's why John Kerry lost in 2004 was abortion. And again, there are more complicated stories to tell about how abortion polling was really bad in this country until very recently. And so there was this myth substantiated by bad data that the country was irrevocably split on abortion. And then that turns out not to be true. In fact, you know, we have majorities supporting abortion access and legality in every state, like red states included. But at the time they were operating off of bad polls. But you had Howard Dean after 2004, who was running up the DNC saying, we need to make our party more welcoming to pro-life Democrats. You had Hillary Clinton telling a group in Albany, I believe this was in 2005, telling a group of reproductive health care providers that we had to make abortion more rare by keeping pregnancies from happening, like telling people who are, you know, who work in contraception, that abortion should be rare. You know, you had the party, and that was true through all those years, where in fact a lot of Democratic voters, perhaps white women like your mother, like me, right, were told that we, like that the notion that to be overly concerned with abortion, which was always presented as safe because of Roe, right? Roe was never going to get overturned. That we were single issue voters if we cared that much about it. If there was, and we couldn't, there were no litmus tests, right? And you had all kinds of people. And this continued up through, that's not just 2004, 2005. That's the Unity Tour in 2017 where you know, Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez go on the road and are talking about some of the same stuff. Nancy Pelosi in 2017 is saying abortion is a fading issue. The Democrats have always said, vote for us because we're the ones who can protect abortion. And then in the same breath, have talked about how we need to make the party a bigger tent, that people who are so overly focused on abortion and it's a kind of feminizing and diminishing approach are like single issue litmus test voters, you know, who are getting in the way of bigger progress. That's always been the message. And that was the message, I'm telling you, the week that the Alito draft leaked, saying we are overturning this law in the starkest ways possible. That week, the first week of May, Democrats were also out there saying, you got to vote for us, right? Sean Patrick Maloney, the from the House, saying basically like vote harder in November. The same week, the Democratic leadership was sending support to Henry Cuellar in Texas, an anti-abortion member of the House and a Democratic incumbent who was being challenged muscularly by Jessica Cisneros, a terrific candidate. And that election came down to something like 200 votes, which means that Democratic leadership that sent all that money and all that support to their anti-choice House member, Cuellar, won him that election. He wouldn't have picked up those extra, whatever it was, 150 votes to beat Jessica Cisneros, a righteous candidate, had it not been for Democratic leadership. And I want to say, we are looking at a future in which every tactic has got to be really carefully thought about. And absolutely, we have to elect people who are going to protect reproductive access and health care in states, right? I don't want this critique to say, so don't vote, okay, right? Because we got to be able to say two things at the same time. But part of what people should be thinking about as they are voting, because damn straight is it incumbent on people to vote, is what kind of party they're voting for and what kind of candidates they're voting for within that party and what kind of messages they want to be sending that party.
All right. I want to make sure that we've walked folks through that, because first of all, I hear your righteous anger in this moment. I hear the frustration I think so many of us, that so many have felt, especially maybe over the course of the weekend while still processing Dobbs and what that was going to mean, and to be getting fundraising text messages and emails and tweets like all weekend, right? The number of folks that I was hearing from about, if I get one more fundraising message, right? And just, you know, that notion of sort of that in this moment, resources are being poured into Democrats, right? And so if that's true, then how do those interested in restoring reproductive rights in this country ensure that the precious resource of their dollars or their vote, right, are going to not just a Democrat, right, but to someone with really that as a top agenda item? And I do, again, not so much to play the blame game, but to try to understand sort of the ways that we all got in a car and drove here together.
Right.
You know, to even go back to 1992, right, and Bill Clinton as a candidate and his phrase.
Our vision should be of an America where abortion is safe and legal, but rare.
And then when Hillary Clinton is running later in 2008 in her first presidential run, she uses rare several times. So it's safe, legal, and rare. She says, and when I say rare, I really mean rare, right? And in a certain way, that's coalition building. That's big tenting. That's bringing in more folks. But I'm wondering also about the ways that it then comes to misunderstand the vulnerability of abortion rights in the ways that you've just articulated.
Right. So safe, legal, and rare is really crucial to understanding the story. And it is rumored, by the way, that Hillary Clinton was the originator of that phrase. That it didn't start with Bill. And that's a phrase that I despise and have been writing about critically forever, because it does this thing, which is cast abortion as some unfortunate outcome rather than as a cornerstone of healthcare, which is what it is. And one of the biggest problems we've had, and this is sort of as a society within our own families, within our civic institutions, within our religious institutions, and within the Democratic Party, and even the pro-choice, another language choice we can talk about later, pro-choice movement, as it was called for a long time, is like, regarding, like, sort of siloing abortion off from the rest of healthcare, which only seeds the frame of there's something icky about abortion, there's something different about abortion, and one of my critiques about how all of this has happened over the five decades that Roe has stood is that we just haven't done a good job of muscularly selling it as a moral, medical, and ideological good, right? And a normal thing. And so safe, legal, and rare was the sort of most powerful political phrasing that articulated that, right? It should have been safe, legal, and immediately accessible to every damn person who needs it, right? Like, that's the idea. And
safe, legal, and accessible is really quite different than safe, legal, and rare.
Yes. Rare casts it as a bad outcome, when in fact, for millions, it is a good outcome, a life-saving outcome, a family-saving outcome. And there are a million different ways to experience individual abortions, as there are a million ways to experience pregnancies themselves, mm-hmm. or other medical procedures, colonoscopies. It is a safe healthcare procedure that is absolutely critical, that happens in every community and every family. And Renee Bracy Sherman, who is an abortion storyteller and activist, has pioneered this phrase, everybody loves someone who has had an abortion. And that's just true. And yet we've treated it as if it's in the special category. And so, yes, Hillary Clinton is rumored to be the architect of that phrasing. I do want to say, though, in the critique of Democrats, she's also somebody who grew in her ability to talk about abortion on public stages, too. And I want to, while I call her out for safe, legal, and rare, and for, like, that speech to providers in Albany, which still makes me cringe, she also articulated first, when she was in her hearings to be Secretary of State in 2009 and was grilled about abortion by Chris Smith, this virulently anti-abortion politician from New Jersey, she gave one of the most just beautiful and impassionately articulated defenses of abortion as crucial to health care that I'd ever heard. And then again, in, I believe, the third debate with Donald Trump, when he tried to do the fictionalized, grisly, ripping babies from bodies language in a debate, she absolutely stood there. And it was, I mean, this is, speaks to how rare it has been to see our major politicians speak with moral passion on these subjects. She just, response to Trump on abortion, including late abortions, was one of the best articulations of a defense of abortion that I have seen from a major politician.
I strongly support Roe v. Wade, which guarantees a constitutional right to a woman to make the most intimate, most difficult, in many cases, decisions about her health care that one can imagine.
So I do want to say, as long as I'm critiquing Hillary, which I do over years around the abortion stuff, I also want to say that she's responsible for two of the best examples of how I've seen major Democratic politicians talk about abortion.
All right. We've been talking a little bit about Hillary Clinton, who I think is such a key figure in sort of all of this, less because she is personally responsible. I don't think there's any one person personally responsible for any of these questions, but because sort of her trajectory from early 90s, right, safe, legal, and rare, through, as you describe it, this very strong articulation in the context of her 2016 debate with Donald Trump and the way she articulates a defense of abortion. Of course, the key thing that presidents do to or have done over the past 50 years to either protect or threaten abortion rights has been the decisions about whom they nominate to the Supreme Court. So Hillary Clinton never had an opportunity to nominate anyone to the Supreme Court. But we did have this moment during her 2016 election bid where President Obama did have an opportunity to nominate someone to the court. His nomination is now the Attorney General of the U.S., Merrick Garland. And of course, Garland never received even a vote. I want to go back to that moment and to the ways that the Garland nomination was handled or mishandled by Democrats, both in the administration and more broadly in the Congress and Senate.
Okay, so it's, gosh, that was, I didn't expect to be actually poleaxed by that very basic question, but there are certain moments where something hits me as so profoundly tragic, and thinking about this moment just actually brought tears to my eyes, which I'm slightly embarrassed by, but have to admit. Because, so we're talking about Democrats and the choices that they've made. And there is no question here, and I get this all the time, why are you blaming Democrats when it's Republicans? Okay, so let's be real clear. The right wing has strategized, and in part by weaponizing the issue of abortion, has strategized a multi-decade takeover of courts, state and local legislatures, school boards, has built this toward this reversal and so many other reversals over decades. The right wing is the malevolent, aggressive actor here. But the Democratic Party is the closest thing we have to their opposition. And so when we're talking about the Democrats, we are talking about how they behaved in direct conflict over life and death policy, legislative, judicial priorities over a period of 50 years. And the moment that you just picked out was in this during Barack Obama's administration, for reasons that are certainly tied to racism and motivated by racism and misogyny, okay? Because it was Barack Obama with Hillary Clinton on deck. You had a Republican Party where the younger generation of radicals was rising, and in fact, the older generation was permitting them to steer the ship. And what you had from, and they were willing to take, in some cases it wasn't breaking institutions because the institutions were designed to enforce all kinds of race, class, and gender inequalities, you know? And so they were using the institutions at hand, like the Electoral College, for example, to win two presidencies over the winner of the popular vote. And what Mitch McConnell was doing in that moment that you cite was taking the institution in which he had so much power and saying, I'm going to break this thing, or I'm going to break the norm around it to get my way. And how did the Democratic Party respond to this violent and immoral incursion on their rights, on their ability to shape a judicial future? Is by not doing much at all. And I remember you had the rise of a right-wing Tea Party, and you had a Democratic Party that was saying, basically, we got this, right? And you had, I remember in those elections, in 2016, you had hard right candidates running around the country crowing about Mitch McConnell's victory. We got that seat. We held that seat open. We won. And you had Democrats who not only had not acted strategically, right? I think, you're a person who once walked me through various other nominations that Barack Obama might have made that could have forestalled this outcome, right? And they didn't publicly treat the opposition party as though they were behaving monstrously and imperiling democracy. The Democrats were not out there telling voters they are taking away your rights to have a popularly elected president determine who's on the Supreme Court. They are perverting, they are manipulating these institutions to serve their extreme ideological goal, and they are depriving you of the judiciary that you should have based on how this system is supposed to work. They weren't making that clear to voters. In addition to not making particularly clear the stakes of having that seat open going into 2016. And that is on Democrats, right? There is a way to be, and I understand, this is a point Dahlia Lithwick has made to me before, like, there's a kind of nihilism operating in the Republican mm-hmm. Party, right? Like, we will take the systems that were built to enforce inequality, and we will squeeze every drop out of them, and we will break the other ones that were, that, you know, the, and it's all in an attempt to to roll back the victories of the late 20th century for, you know, all kinds of civil rights movements and political and social movements. We will do anything to strip this stuff back and to regain our minority power, right? And there's just been a kind of passivity in their opponents. And a faith that those institutions will stand. A faith that we have ample evidence in front of us right now, unfolding over a period, the better part of a decade, that no, those institutions may not in fact stand.
Then I want to walk through two emotions with you. One is anger. And, you know, your text around women's anger suggests the possibility of anger being revolutionary. Now, I want to be very clear. There are women who are not angry about the Dobbs decision. Mm-hmm. There are many women very much at the core of the movement to overturn Roe v. Wade and to end abortion rights in this country. So I do not want to conflate identity with political position here. But for women who are angry about this, is there still a revolutionary possibility, or at least do you believe and see that there could be? What is that rooted in?
There has to be. What if we say there isn't? There has to be. That's the only way to move forward. And I think it's really incumbent on people to remember, and I think that this is particularly for people who are only recently, have only recently come to anger from this angle, because as you say, it is crucial to say that women's anger has also in part motivated the anti-abortion movement, right? And all kinds of, you know, anti-desegregation movements, you know, like women's anger operates in lots of directions on behalf of a system and in challenge to that system. But for the anger that is in challenge to that system right now, one of the things that I think is incumbent on those who lived with relative assurance and comfort that things wouldn't get bad, that we were moving in one direction, right? That comfort is afforded by privilege and insulation, right? Because Roe has been being hollowed out and eroded and made an abortion made all but inaccessible to vast swaths of this country long before it was overturned. You know, there have been millions of people who've had to travel and suffer and forced to carry pregnancies they didn't want. There have been people who have been, you know, been in prison. This has been happening in this country, and it's a failure of the political parties and the media to not have made that plainer as it was happening. But for those who are recently to anger, I think that we have done a bad job of teaching history in this country and of being really clear about how long progress takes, and that it can and has been reversed multiple times in our history, and that people operating from places actually with far less than what we have even now, as this has been wholly overturned and so much else around labor protections and voting rights has been overturned. And we are operating from a bad place now, and it's going to get worse. And I think it's really crucial that we're plain about that, because I think the, like, don't worry, it's not as bad as you think is totally a lie and also anesthetizing, right? And makes you think, oh, things will be okay. There's going to be a system that saves me. Nope, you save you. So, and more importantly, others. But I think that people forget, because there was this period of like half a century where there was a kind of feel good narrative being told about how things were just getting better and more equal, right? And those of us, and I include myself here, born in 1975, who were raised within that era, do not have a keen sense of the generations that came before them starting their fights with greater and more punitive structural battles and impediments, who nonetheless were willing to give their entire lives toward working for that revolutionary possibility, a possibility that they would not see come to fruition in their lifetimes, but that in fact would never have come to fruition if they hadn't been willing to work through their entire lives, right? And in recent decades, there has been inculcated in an American populace a real desire for quick payoff, right? So, man, the number of people I have heard, not just since overturn, but since the leak and before that, you know, like, well, what can we do? What can we do to reverse this right now? And I'm like, I mean, now, wait a minute. I also want to say, this is, you know, that doesn't mean that some of the immediate, like, not to be the Democrats and say vote harder, but like the elections Every election is going to matter. Every election is going to matter. So not only find candidates that you want to vote for, become candidates you want to vote for, encourage people around you to become candidates you want to vote for, look to people like the people who run for something that, you know, is encouraging a new generation of Democrats with 100%, you know, pro-choice politics to get into politics, all that, that there is stuff that's quick. But we are also looking at a very long haul on many fronts and not just about abortion. And it is incumbent on us to dig into that long haul fight and absolutely to believe that the revolutionary promise is still ahead of us, but also to acknowledge that if it's not ahead of us, like in my lifetime, that doesn't get me off the hook for spending the rest of my life working toward it. And in fact, it makes it all the more important that I give the rest of my life working for it.
Rebecca Traister, writer for New York Magazine and author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.